Thanks, Brother Ken. Well, Brother Brian earlier on in the week said that Isaiah chapter 21 was one of those chapters that was interesting and challenging. And the opportunity this night of coming to grips with this chapter has always been difficult to comprehend will probably evaporate after Brian has exposed it to us. So we now ask Brother Brian to lead us in the consideration of Isaiah chapter 21. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, dear Brother Keith and my beloved brethren and sisters. I don't know that all the problems will evaporate tonight, but we do hope that our hour or so together will be useful in unravelling a chapter which clearly is quite a difficult one to read. I don't suppose there's anyone that read chapter 21 tonight that said, well, I feel quite happy about all that means. Did you feel like that? Or did you rather think, my word, there's some peculiar statements in this prophecy? And all commentators reflect the same way upon chapter 21 of Isaiah. I just wanted to mention one thing, my dear brothers and sisters, you know, watchman, what of the night? Just turn back to the third chapter of Isaiah. What of the night? What of our night, just for a moment, my dear brothers and sisters, the world in which we're living? You know, Isaiah says in verse 16, moreover, Yahweh said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet. Remember when we did that chapter in Isaiah, we saw in fact that these women, for the sight was around the temple, were in fact attracting attention to themselves that was comparable to what should only go to the high priest of Israel. He had bells by his feet, didn't he? They were in the precincts of the God's place of worship, challenging the very auspicious nature of the high priesthood itself. These women of Israel, in a public site, taking over the public position. You know, yesterday, and today it was in the paper as well, we had a most remarkable experience. In the one day, two women became prime ministers of very different countries. Canada has just appointed a woman as the prime minister. I'm sorry, Ken, she has. Yeah. Yes, but she is now prime minister. Yeah. And they've had a very unpopular man there as the head of the Conservative Party. And would you believe it, this woman has come to the fore in her party, and he, realising that his popularity stakes are so low, has decided that he will stand down before the election, which, as Brother Ken was saying, is due, I think, the latter part of this year, November, December. So he stands down now that she might be able to sort of get the ropes before the election comes up. That woman is the epitome of an arrogant, insolent public woman. Twice divorced, goes by the title of Ms., and therefore advocates to all that nation, to all the young girls of that nation, that marriage and all of it stand for doesn't count a fig. Can you imagine, my dear brothers, that a nation that once swore on the Bible, probably still does, is now prepared to have a woman like that as its prime minister? That's the most incredible thing. You know, women have been great before. Queen Victoria was great. So was Deborah. But look at the quality of the people involved. Now we have a woman like that. Now, if that's not remarkable enough, what about the next one? Where would you think that one of the most unlikely areas that a woman could ever become prime minister? Surely in a Muslim country. Why? In Muslim countries, the sheikhs, you know, sort of change their wives like they change their socks. And they don't have to have any more than the faintest excuse. And out goes one and in comes another to join the other half a dozen he's already got. And that's what it's like in Muslim countries. The position of the woman is very, very downpressed. Turkey has a woman prime minister. And she's a Ms. as well. Now, isn't that absolutely incredible? Absolutely a most remarkable thing. You know, have a look at Revelation chapter 16. In Revelation chapter 16, it says that the spirit of democracy will be seen in all the world It says in verse 13, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now we know who the false prophet is. That's the prophet of Rome, the Pope. The mouth of the beast is Central Europe, and the dragon was essentially the East, which in earlier times had its capital in Constantinople, today called Istanbul, the head of Turkey. The capital of the country of Turkey. And I don't think anybody would ever have imagined that Turkey, a Muslim country, 95% of it's not 99% of the country are Muslim. And they now have a woman who is as brash as Mrs. Clinton. You'd have to believe it to see it. She is now the Prime Minister of Turkey. Can you believe that? Would you have imagined that a country like Turkey, as Muslim as it is, could appoint a woman, and a brash Western style modern woman with walks haughty and has an arrogant air, just brimful of arrogance and determination and willpower? She now, in a country like Turkey, is Prime Minister. And she's a mess.
The interesting thing with her is that when she married her husband in 1960, she persuaded him to take her name.
Yes.
Incredible, isn't it?
It really is incredible. Well, the headquarters of the dragon in old time was Constantinople, and there's the clearest evidence that the spirit of the frogs has taken over the whole of the East as well, and rapidly doing so. We saw it in the Russian re-revolution that we've witnessed. But there, I thought, just in something which we might otherwise go right over, there is the clearest evidence that this kind of spirit is filling the world. And so we say to our own young girls too, beware of those trends. Be very careful in our ways, our young girls and sisters, to preserve the way of a godly woman, the way of a daughter of Sarah, that is chaste and sober and submissive, womanly, a lover of home and a family, and that is our goals with our girls. That is what we must desperately hold on. The most fundamental things, my dear brothers and sisters, are being challenged by a world in which we live. And as you look at it, you just wonder, what could it be next that would be challenged? The very fundamental items, man and woman, it's been completely overturned. And we say to our dear young girls and sisters, beware. Keep your mind in the Bible. Never mind what the teachers at school tell you about what your role ought to be, or what the world tells you from its magazines. You concentrate on the Bible, and God will tell us what that role is, as he has told us in days of old. Well, Isaiah chapter 21 begins a series of five burdens. The opening phrase is rather difficult. It says, the burden of the desert of the sea. Whatever might that mean? You don't have a desert in a sea, do you? What's it mean, the burden of the desert of the sea? As I said, it's the first of five. The second is in verse 11. The burden of Jumah. Verse 13, the burden upon Arabia. That's number three. Number four is in chapter 22, verse 1. The burden of the valley of vision. And that goes right through chapter 22 until we come to chapter 23, the burden of Tyre. And then we have a different section, chapters 24 to 26, a different section. So it's interesting, isn't it? The five burdens. And they are really quite different. I mean, the first one goes verses 1 to 10. The second one's very short. The burden of Jumah, two verses. The most intriguing little verses indeed. We may not in fact get that far tonight. We may not complete the chapter. But then verse 13 swings around. It's in a different place altogether to where we started in chapter 21 verse 1. And what might it mean in verse 1 of chapter 22? The burden of the valley of vision. What's that? Take another interesting title of the prophecy. The 28th chapter. Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine. Some of these titles are quite difficult, aren't they? What about chapter 27 and verse 1? In that day, Yahweh with his soaring great and strong sword shall pierce Leviathan. So he doesn't always make it easy in starting off, does he? And so we come back with this title, The Burden of the Desert of the Sea. And we think, well, I wonder what that means. Does desert mean desert? Does sea mean sea? Yes, they do. Sea means the sea. And the desert does mean the desert. As a matter of fact, you've got the same thing in the next phrase, the same word for desert. In the next phrase it says, as whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert, from a terrible land. A terrible land means a scorched land, a dry, a harsh land. For example, if you turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 1, you will remember a very well-known description of the region of Sinai and the wilderness through which Israel came. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 19. And when we departed from Horeb, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness, right? A terrible land. A desert. And Isaiah has said, as whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert, from a terrible land. Stop and think about that. There's a simile being made. As whirlwinds in the south pass through. That word south is the word Negev. And that's, of course, south of Israel, isn't it? We all know where the Negev is. Israel handed it back to Egypt. And that word south is the word Negev. So in other translations you'll find that they put it there as a proper name. As whirlwinds in the Negev pass through. And if you've been to Israel, you may have experienced that. We went right down to Mount Sinai one day, and a couple of days we were down there, and on our way back one of these winds struck up. And it made our tour coming up on the western side of the Red Sea in this area here. We were coming up from Mount Sinai along the road that runs along the slip of the Red Sea here, and it was absolutely terrible. There was this ferocious south wind sweeping in, not fully south, but south and east, and it comes in like that. By the time we got to, I think we were going to the Flower Caves. You may have heard about the Flower Caves from others, but by the time we got there, and they're almost level with Jerusalem, not too far south of Jerusalem, we were absolutely cooked in that bus. So I'll never forget that as an experience of the whirlwinds coming up from the south, terribly hot and scorching. A very memorable experience indeed. So that's what he's speaking about. And he says that will be comparable to what is going to come upon whoever this burden is going to come upon. So it cometh from the desert, from a terrible land. So the burden, which is a judgment, is going to come from a terrible land, from a desert land. Now that helps us a bit, because we've got a contrast now, haven't we? We've got the burden of the desert of the sea. And then we've got another desert land from which this wind of destruction, this invasion, is going to come. So if that's the desert of the sea, then perhaps this is a different type of desert. Also a harsh land. Also a wilderness. But a different land. Well, we know, in fact, who the whirlwinds are going to be. They're going to be the forces of Elam and Media, because it tells us that in verse 2, see? A grievous vision is declared unto me, the treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoiler spoileth. There's a picture that Isaiah sees of terrible invasion. Who's involved in this? Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media, all the sighing thereof have I made to cease. So it's the company of the Elamites and the Medians. They are coming up as whirlwinds, coming from the desert, from a terrible land. All right, where did they come from? Well, they came from an area which was rather mountainous. Oh, perhaps I could show it on here, but it doesn't. Perhaps it does show up better. Am I in your way? These mountains here are called the Zagros Mountains. Here's the Persian Gulf. Here's the Euphrates. Here's the Tigris. And these mountains are called the Zagros Mountains. Down in this area here arose the Persians, first known as the Kingdom of Incheon. Up in this larger area here was where the Medes settled. They in fact came from the same people, from the Aryan people that came from the east. That's what they called themselves. Same word that Hitler used to use, remember? Don't ask me any connection now, I don't know. But it's the same word, historically. They came from the east and they settled here. The smaller group came into this area here and were later known as the Persians. And the larger group settled in here and were known as the Medes. Today we would collectively call that Iran, all right? Persia of old, if you like, because the name Persia then expanded and became dominant for the whole of that area. So we today would call that Iran or Persia. Two peoples from a common origin. Now between them was an area here called Elam. And Elam was living partly in the mountains and partly on this very fertile plain between the mountains and the river Tigris. That's where the men of Elam were. And the Medes, as we've said, were further up, inhabiting these mountains and this kind of elevated plateau, which is Iran. So that's where they're going to come from. These whirlwinds of verse 1 are coming from the desert, from a terrible land. And they're going to fall. The burden of God's word is such that they're going to fall upon the desert of the sea. Now, when you put that together, the logic of it comes out, doesn't it? We're not looking upon a wilderness as in a high country, but a wilderness that's related to the sea, that's on the flat, so to speak. And undoubtedly, of course, that's what's referred to. We know that it is Babylon that's involved because verse 9 tells us that. The result, he answered and said, Babylon is fallen. So the invading whirlwinds of the great forces of Elam and the Medes come upon Babylon, which is here very poetically and interestingly described as the desert of the sea, the desert or the wilderness of the sea. And as you can see, excuse the pun, as you can see on this map here, this that is in green is all very much like sea level. Here's sea level. So anything that's green is between that and 600 feet, sort of 300 metres. Very flat, in other words, all through that piece of ground. Quite interesting, isn't it? But it's more related to the sea than that. You've got two great rivers that flow down from this collection of mountains here, and they sort of fall down through these rivers until they just collect because they can't get out quick enough. And so because of that, you have tremendous areas of marshlands in all this southern area. If you've got very good eyes, you might be able to see that there's lots of lakes indicated here. There's one, in fact, called the Sea of Something. Sea of... I didn't notice it earlier. I can't just see the name of it here. But it's actually called the Sea. And there's a very famous waterway here which has been in our newspapers in more recent years, because the border between Iran and Iraq is now on this waterway. And it's called the Shat et Arab, which means the Arab waterway. And it's like a huge wide channel of the Persian Gulf that goes right up inland, as though the sea would project into the land itself. And I think perhaps that's the reason why it is given this interesting description, this rather poetic description of the desert of the sea, surrounded with marshlands. Do you remember what's been happening in that region in more recent times, in the events of the world? What's been happening down there in the last, say, 6 months, 12 months, since the war with Iraq? What's America been doing? This southern area is very much inhabited by Shiite Muslims. They are a threat to Saddam Hussein, who reigns from Baghdad. You've got no time for Shiite Muslims. They're fanatics, and they are worried to him because they're much, much more prepared to put their religion ahead of him. And they'd toss him tomorrow if they could, so they're a threat to him. He's more interested in his own power than he is in religion. Religion can be used as a tool, but look out if you try to be fair dinkum about it. So the Shiites are a real problem to him. And so he has set about a policy to endeavour to exterminate them. Well, how can you exterminate them when they're living all among these marshes? There's reeds, miles and miles of reeds and marshlands. And so they make their little huts and their boats all among these reeds. How could he therefore eradicate them from those areas? And we're talking of hundreds of thousands of them. The only thing he could do was put planes over and bomb them out of existence. So America said, look, you're not going to bring planes down to this area. You've already attacked Kuwait. And one of the grounds of the agreement when they made the ceasefire with Iraq after the war over Kuwait was that they would not be able to bring their planes into this area. And if they do, America immediately puts fighters into the sky and blows them out of the sky. Now that evidence is what we're trying to say, that that area, you see, is predominant with marshland. It's as though the sea intruded into the desert or into the wilderness. So geography, perhaps, is the biggest key to helping us understand the concept which is behind this expression in verse 1. The burden that is going to come upon Babylon, here poetically described as the desert of the sea. Now, in the prophecy of Jeremiah, there's some interesting passages. Put these together. Jeremiah chapter 50. Have you seen photos of Babylon and of the area of the Euphrates and Tigris? These two great rivers, you see, that lock this landmass between them. That's what Mesopotamia means. You can see it here on the map. It's this area between the rivers. In fact, in the Arabic, it's called, Mesopotamia is called the island. It's between these branches of the sea, if you like. So very interesting, isn't it? Very interesting indeed. The desert of the sea. Well, in Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 38, we read, "And a drought is upon her waters." This is a judgment upon Babylon, the Chaldeans, verse 35. "A drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up, for it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols." Just remember that expression for later too, about the idols. "A drought is upon her waters," you see. That was a very preeminent part of Babylon. Verse 13. "O thou that," of chapter 51. "O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end is come, and the measure of thy covetousness." This great river Euphrates went right through the city, and because it was flat, they were able to take out their channels on every side of the river. So whether you're 15 miles down there, still within the compass of the city, you could run these channels down and you could be out there producing little wares in metal or leather, whatever it might be, but you could put them into the boat, take them down to the Euphrates, that would go down to the Persian Gulf and you were on the waterways of the world. So it was a very significant city. It was in the world, Babylon was, because of its waterways. "O thou that dwellest upon many waters." Chapter 51, verse 36. Waters, waters, waters everywhere. "Therefore thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will plead thy cause and take vengeance for thee, and I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry, Consistent, isn't it? Very consistent terminology. Verse 42. The sea has come up upon Babylon. She is covered with the multitude of the waves thereof. Verse 44. And I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will bring forth out of his mouth that which he hath swallowed up, and the nations shall not flow together any more unto him. Yea, the wall of Babylon shall fall. Verse 55. Because Yahweh hath spoiled Babylon and destroyed her, and destroyed out of her the great voice, when her waves do roar like great waters, a noise of their voice is uttered. And so there the waters are sort of merging into the symbolic sense of the nations of the world. And that's what it was like. Because she was on the waters, it was like she was on the crest of the wave of world dominion and importance. Coming back to Isaiah, just link it up also with this one in the 23rd chapter. Verse 13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this people was not till the Assyrians founded it. For them that dwell in the desert, they set up the towers thereof, they raise up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. So Babylon was built by people of Assyrian culture and history. And it was built for them that dwell in the wilderness. So we have the burden of the desert, of the sea. All right, that's the same word that we have as the word desert in chapter 21, verse 1. So, Isaiah's made us think, but it's a very interesting consideration to think of all those different references, to go through those references and see the significance. So a mountain power is going to descend upon a power of the plain. Now, in verse 2 it says, a grievous vision is declared unto me. That's Isaiah. A grievous vision. What he's now going to say is not because of words so much put into his mouth, but because of something that his eyes have seen. He describes it by the Spirit of God. A grievous vision is declared unto me. Something that he will actually see. Now that's interesting. What's it going to be? The destruction of Babylon. That has therefore very interesting echoes with Daniel chapter 5, doesn't it? And here's the first of many comparisons with Daniel 5. In Daniel chapter 5, we have the famous night described in which Babylon was taken. The king at that time was Belshazzar, wasn't he? The great grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, who had called a feast for 1,000 of his lords. And in that lascivious environment, they revelled and drank from the golden vessels, verse 3, that were taken out of the temple of the house of God. That was the environment. And it was while that was taking place that the fingers were seen of the man's hand that were writing upon the wall, Meni, Meni, Euthel, Tekel, Euphasen. Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. So by a vision, Daniel told the people of the judgment of Babylon on the very time that it occurred. But here in chapter 21 of Isaiah, we are 150 years approximately before that event. But Isaiah was given a grievous vision, as he describes it. A hard vision. A harsh vision. That's the sense of it. Something that was not pleasant to look upon. It staggered him in the depth of what was involved. Tremendous consequences were involved in the vision which he saw. And struck by this, he says, the treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoiler spoileth. So he's seen a picture, hasn't he, of invasion. Ever seen film shot of invasion, what men are like in times of invasion, or read those war books, what happens when they come into a city? What would you do if you were a soldier and years away from your family and so forth and your country? And you come then into a country that has been preventing you from getting back to your home people. You know what people do? They rummage through the place, don't they? They spoil and loot and take whatever they want and act as animals. You read the story of the Russian soldiers that came into the Germanic lands from the east at the end of World War II. They just looted the place with revenge and hatred. Well, it's often said, isn't it, that integrity, honesty, is the first victim in time of war. And these men dealt treacherously. The treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously. Any means by which they could obtain their end and find the victory which they sought. In the 24th chapter, verse 16, you have this same expression. It's not particularly analogous here in its context, but I just want to make the point that that's exactly what it means. The treacherous dealer will deal treacherously. Translation's quite accurate. The deceitful, the treacherous dealer will deal deceitfully. In other words, all integrity and covenant will be destroyed in the hour of his invasion. From the uttermost part of the earth, 24 verse 16, have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Same expression. And again, it's a time of divine judgment that's coming upon the world of iniquity at that time. So there's a statement, you see, that there'll be no way out of this. These people have come. Don't worry about their covenants. Don't worry about their words. Their actions will betray all of such covenants or words. They come with treachery and the desire for spoil. Who are these people? Go up, O Elam. Besiege, O Media. All the sighing thereof have I made to cease. So in the vision, Isaiah has incorporated it as though he's personally involved in this vision. He feels the tremendous strain of it, verse 2, and then he, in the Spirit of God, calls upon these powers. O Elam, come up! O Median, come forth! He says. What an amazing person he was to be so incorporated into the visions and actions of Almighty God as to feel that he himself was calling them up. See how the prophets were exceedingly important, my dear brothers. Did they come? What were the men of Elam doing when Isaiah spoke these words to Judah 150 years before they came to pass? I'm sure the women were just hanging out their washing, weren't they? They didn't have any idea what the prophet in Judah was happening to say about these things. You see, people in Judah knew. This, therefore, was in the record for 150 years, just lying there. And people would read it and say, poor old Isaiah, so they had some fits from time to time. Look at the silly things he wrote. I wonder what all that means. But you see, in process of time came to pass. That's what's going to happen to Ezekiel 38. Silly old Christadelphians. They've been saying that for years. Russia! Oh, Russia's finished. Yeah. Art thou not he of whom I spoke in ancient times? See? When the right time comes and the hooks are put in the jaws, it will do the work that God has said. Elam didn't have any knowledge of this. But later on, when they came and they sat in the pinnacle of Babylon, and Daniel perhaps brought this chapter up, as he did undoubtedly, the chapter which had to do with the very name of Cyrus, chapter 44 and chapter 45. He would have said, there's Elam mentioned. As we said, this is the area of Elam, just there. When the Persians began to expand from here through the brilliant leadership of the young man Cyrus, who was son-in-law to Astyages, who was the leader of Media, the first area that he sort of took over was Elam. So in a sense, Elam and Persia became one thing. And then he merged Media with that. So it became the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. The Medes more numerous in size, greater in numbers, I mean, and greater in size of area. But Elam was sort of in with all that. So it's a brilliantly accurate depiction which we have here 150 years before they knew anything about what they were supposed to do. This is not the first reference to Media, is it? What was the other chapter? that Brother Peter spoke on, that mentioned the Medes involved. Which chapter was that? Come on, we were all here. Which chapter was that? Not so long ago? Chapter 13? Here's a whole chapter. The burden of Babylon. Chapter 13, verse 1. He could have said that again, I suppose. But he made us think, didn't he? The burden of the desert of the sea. We enjoyed that. Working something out, see? God conceals about it and makes you think about it. So in chapter 13, verse 17, having earlier described these people as, verse 3, his sanctified ones, he now tells us exactly who they were. Verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, against Babylon. So here, this great conquest of Babylon by the Medo-Persian power was spoken of earlier in chapter 13, verse 17. And as I said, the whole of that chapter is taken up with a description of that occasion. So you'll find that there are similarities between chapter 21, verses 1 to 10, and the descriptions which you found in chapter 13. Now, what do you think then at the end of verse 2, that last little phrase might mean? All the sighing thereof have I made to cease. Well, I suppose it's difficult to be dogmatic about that, but if you take the context of the thought, it says, a grievous vision is declared unto me, and then he describes the dire attitude, the determined attitude, the resolute attitude of the treacherous dealer and the spoiler that would set his mind upon the spoil. In the context of that, it then says, all the sighing thereof have I made to cease. So is it not something perhaps like this, that before it actually happens, you hope it won't, eh? So you sort of heave and sigh, hoping that it won't, but it's gone. He's come. He truly has come and done his work. They thought there was a hope of escape, but in fact, all their signs were made to cease. The spoiler came, the invasion occurred, and they were taken. Now, in the following two verses, we have the prophet's personal grief. This is terribly interesting, isn't it? Would you cry over the spoil of Russia, my dear brothers and sisters? Would you feel weakened, like a woman in travail of giving birth, at the destruction of, who shall we say, of Saddam Hussein, of Iran, Iraq? I wonder. How do you think Isaiah felt about Babylon? Babylon that was the other end of the earth, spiritually, to Israel. But look at verses 3 and 4. This is Isaiah speaking personally of the tremendous movement that he felt at the tragic fall of Babylon. Therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. The people were listening to the man. There was sunshine outside and the wind was just gently blowing through Jerusalem. What's wrong with this man? Another one of these fits? Is he some kind of epileptic? As he's going through the city, holding his stomach in grief and agony, as he tries to appeal to the people with what he has seen. My heart panted, verse 4. Fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. Tremendous, wasn't it? He was absolutely taken over by what he saw. It's quite remarkable to see how the prophets of God were taken over by the things which they saw to bring the message home. And you know, that ought to be a very good evidence to all of our younger brethren who teach from the Word. If you teach apathetically, if you teach as though you're not really involved in it, as though you don't really care, people come and go just like that. You'll have as much movement upon them as it will upon you. It'll always have less, in fact, won't it? But if there's no enthusiasm about what we speak about, Why do we think the friends will be converted? Do you listen to someone over the radio who's just twaddling on all day? You could turn him off as easy as you could turn him on. He doesn't mean anything to you, does he? What about these people? They're always going on all day long. Could be this, could be that, maybe, perhaps. All that. What do? You turn the book, you turn off the radio. Nothing in them, is there? But if a person speaks, stands up and says, this is what should be done. This is the right. You listen to that. Because he knows something. Well, at least he sounds as though he knows something. And it's a very interesting thing to see that Isaiah, godly man that he was, obviously when he spoke to the people, when he brought God's message to them, it was not apathetically given. And that's a good thing for our young men to know. If there's going to be persuasion upon us as listeners, you've got to feel what you're talking about. You've got to have your heart and soul involved in it. Chapter 13. This is very similar. I've told you that these two chapters have got lots of similarities. I won't be going back very much, but it'd be a very good little exercise. Just put a little note in your pad. Make a comparison, chapter 13 and chapter 21, verses 1 to 10. Verse 7, therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. And they shall be afraid, pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another, their faces shall be as flames. What was Isaiah really doing? Yes, it was his own feelings, but what he was doing was entering in to the feelings of those in the street of Babylon when they saw suddenly coming from every point of the compass the Medes swarming into their streets and there was no way out. In a dramatic way, 150 years and 500 miles away was feeling what would happen at that time to the average citizen of Babylon. What an incredibly interesting thing. It's almost the same words, isn't it? Almost the same words. In chapter 13, it's describing the citizens of Babylon. In chapter 21, Isaiah is saying, therefore are my loins filled with pain. Well, that's an exceedingly interesting thing, isn't it? In the 38th Psalm, I have an interesting expression of this involvement of the medium with his message. Chapter 38, verse 6. I am troubled, I am bowed down greatly, I go mourning all the day long. There's the kind of feeling which Isaiah had. I am troubled, I'm bowed down greatly. That was a psalm which was also pointing to Messiah. So in a similar way, Isaiah is pointing forward to the lot of the inhabitants of Babylon, the day that would come. But being a man of feeling and compassion, he could not but express that as his own feeling. And you know, that's God, who's not desirous that any should fail, is he? He would have all men to come to repentance. If we look again in the 15th chapter, you might remember these expressions, do you? Chapter 15, verse 5. This is about Moab. My heart shall cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar. My heart shall cry out for Moab. Chapter 16, verse 9. Therefore I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon. What an incredible thing to say. Verse 11, wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab. Moab, the treacherous ex-cousin of Israel. That the prophet may well have said, Moab, you get all that you deserve and wish you got more. But he didn't, did he? Mine eyes shall weep for Moab. These were great people, truly living, real people. The issues of the world that they lived in were real to them. And so in the 20th chapter, in a different way, but in the equal sense of servitude, we read in the 20th chapter in verse 3, Yahweh said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia. Do you like to go around without a full suit of clothes? In the cold of Jerusalem's winter? Do you know it? On an average, every second year they have snow in Jerusalem. You like to be getting around without anything on your feet? You wouldn't know whether you had feet after a while, would you? I suppose it would be all right once you couldn't feel them. But it would be a terrible experience, wouldn't it? And very little clothing. He went 3 years like that as a warning to the people who were south of Egypt. What an incredible thing. Telling Israel effectively, don't you worry about putting your hope in Egypt or in Ethiopia south of Egypt, because Assyria will come down and you'll conquer them. And he went like that for 3 years. And you know, sometimes we think we can't even sit up, can we, to do a bit of Bible study. Oh, I go to sleep. I can't study. Don't give me a book. I couldn't read it. Helps are too big. Just give me a magazine article. 2.5 pages. That's me. I'm finished. What a lot of lazy bones we are, aren't we? We sit with a lovely room, nice walls, carpet on the floor, heater, light just where we like it. Mum coming in with a cuppa, or wife, or whatever. Everything laid on. What a lot of lazy bones we are. And this man was prepared to go for 3 years, and he felt it all that time. He was giving a powerful witness to the people about another power so far away from them. So says Isaiah in chapter 8 and verse 18. How true are these words? Chapter 8 and verse 18. Behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from Yahweh of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. How do you think that his children felt when Dad was getting around half clad and having all these cold feet and getting perhaps himself full of flu and influenza and all sorts of other things that he may indeed have got through that? And people looking in and say, where's that man going to put some decent clothes on? Why doesn't he make sure that his tie matches his socks, like I'm told every week? All right? He wasn't concerned, was he? He probably didn't have a tie. A lot of other things too. But he was there because of the advocacy of the message of God. He was consumed by that. And don't hesitate to bring your children into that service. If you want to make sure that they don't know it, then modelly coddle them. Make sure that everything in their room is just as they want it, as they demand that it must be, and you'll get softies that will never be able to stand up to the message of the truth in the latter days. We don't want softies. We want children that have been disciplined, that know how to be put back, and can see the wisdom of that. Because when they come up, they'll make good ecclesial members, good servants of Christ, good partners in marriage, good people at work, because they know how to serve. And the world's the opposite message, isn't it? But Isaiah had his children to stand with him. And no doubt they may have thought to themselves, my dad is really the sight of the town and everybody's talking. They stood with him. I and my children are for signs and for wonders in Israel. Don't breed softies. And children who hear that, accept the role that your parents are applying. If they are asking you for discipline in your life, if they are asking of you something, look beyond what other people might say and see that your mother and your father are asking you the right thing. Christ is service. If Christ isn't service, what is it? Are our children just to rise up and do as they want to do it? Every woman fancy? But a lot of spoiled cats we'll have all around here. The truth will be sunk with it, won't they? What we believe for our family, we believe because of the word of God, that's what's done. We're not soft. We have principles that we're endeavouring to bring to our kiddies. And in the end, they will love us for that. Make no mistake about that. They will love you for standing on those principles. And already the wise ones that are growing in years, they can see already that's really true, can't you? A lot of you already know that, I know. So, in that way too, we are fighting against the trends of the world in which we live. Take some of those phrases in verse 3 and 4. Therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me. As a woman in travail, which I couldn't imagine could be much worse. A terrible thing at times. Wonderful results, but there wouldn't be a wonderful result out of this. That's a tremendous description that we have there in verse 3. My heart panteth, verse 4. Literally, my heart wandereth. I can't keep on thinking of the one thing. It's too awful to think about. So my heart wanders, as the word means. Fearfulness affrighteth me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear upon me. Does that make you think of something? What happened on the night that Babylon fell? Come through to Daniel chapter 5. The very chapter we have that tells us about what happened. Didn't I say that Isaiah was sharing the feelings of the inhabitants of Babylon? Well, those inhabitants went right up to the king himself. You have a look at Daniel chapter 5, verse 6. The king saw the writing, verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand, and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, his heart wandered, he didn't know what to think, he was at a party, but he felt like a woman in travail. No kind of a party, was it? And his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against another. He was altogether taken over with exactly what had come upon the prophet 150 years before. Fearfulness affrighted me, my heart panted. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. And it was, wasn't it? He called all the lords, 1,000 around, to that feast. The night of his pleasures, he forgot the taste of wine. He was in a great state of perturbation as he conceived what was in fact going to happen. But look at verse 5. What do you make of verse 5? Is that confusion? Prepare the table, watch in the watchtower. Whatever's that got to do with each other? And the next two phrases, eat, drink, arise ye princes, and anoint the shield. What's that saying? Well, you can put the first phrase together with a third one, can't you? Prepare the table, what for? For eat and drink. Watch in the watchtower, be ready for anointing the shield and going out to battle to defend your place. And so the prophet has mixed them up. See the point? He's mixed them up. You're at a feast to have a good time. Prepare the table for food and for drink. But the other side of you is saying, watch in the watchtower. Race! Take hold of your shield and go to defend the palace and the city. That's exactly what that verse 5 is saying. Now I think that is... Look, if you want to know, young people, you have a look at that. If you want to know the inspiration of your Bible, just take a look at that. How could that ever be understood except we had, for example, the counter story of history of exactly what happened that night. The Bible is the most thrilling and wonderful thing. Talk about a verifier of our faith, isn't it? That's exactly what happened that night, isn't it? What was Belshazzar doing? You look in Daniel chapter 5. He was having a great time. A big idiot he was. A big idiot. A young man that had grown up and didn't know the sweat and toil of his parents or his great-grandfather. And so, in Daniel chapter 5, he has 1,000 of his lords drinking wine before them. And it's a great lascivious feast. And coming up the valley, or the plain, between the two rivers, the river Euphrates here, and the river, river Tigris here, was the forces of the Persians and Medes. And everybody knew it. And this young fool head thought that he could have a party when the invader was at the walls of the city. He felt that he was impregnable within Babylon. And so as an act of foolish foolhardiness, he calls all the lords of his kingdom, and it was a wide kingdom, to come and have a party in the time of invasion. What an idiot. Prepare the table, wine and drink. And the next minute they were running for their shoes. Isn't that incredibly interesting, my dear brothers and sisters? You see what Daniel says in verse 5? In the same hour. In the very same hour. With all that preparing of the table. Even taking the golden vessels. They were kept in a special place because of their unique quality, their very beautiful work, and that they were taken from the house of the living God in Jerusalem. Never been used apparently like this before. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, and of wood and of stone. In the same hour, they went for their shields. And that's exactly what Isaiah had said. And in the last little expression of that chapter, verse 30, after Daniel had told them what it meant, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. So what a wonderful thing the Bible is, my dear brothers and sisters. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. What an incredibly interesting description that is. You can't help but see the miraculous nature of the Bible. And what do you think later on, you see, when the Jews who were present in Babylon, and they went back to Isaiah and they read that. Oh, they would have thrilled, wouldn't they? Not just thrilled that Babylon was fallen, but to see that Isaiah's very little inference and words were so majestically fulfilled at the time. And so Belshazzar's pride was in a night turned to grief. Now in the following verses, verses 6 to 8, we have a call for a watchman. A call for a watchman. Thus hath the Lord said unto me, go set a watchman, let him declare what he seeth. Now why should he do that? Why should he be asked to find a watchman? Let him declare what he seeth. Now I don't think for a moment, my dear brothers and sisters, that Isaiah walked out of his house and walked down the street and found a watchman. Do you? Is that how you read it? Let him declare what he seeth. Do you know what he would have declared? He would have said, oh, there's no buildings around here and here's a tree. He wasn't going to see. So you know the message of the watchman is in verse 9. Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Now no local watchman around the place would have known that message, would he? So this is still part of the vision. You got me? In the vision, Isaiah swept up into the vision. And in the middle of the vision, God says to him, go set a watchman. So it's in the vision, you see. So in the vision, the prophet goes and gets a watchman. And he puts him in his place. But it's still in the vision because that watchman tells him the prophecy. Get the picture? So it's still part of the vision that we were introduced to in verse 2. You happy with that? You agree with that? There's no local watchman might have come from the wall of Jerusalem is going to know Babylon has fallen, has fallen. See, that's part of the future knowledge. All right. It says in verse 6, go set a watchman, let him declare what he seeth. So the watchman is being brought into the picture that he might that he might emphasize the importance of the message. A watchman is a man of urgency and vigilance. The message was going to be proclaimed, like the watchman was there for that very purpose. And so now, 150 years before it shall come to pass, in the vision, he was told to find a watchman and let him declare what he seeth. You see, this was not a small thing to say. That Babylon should fall. Look how Babylon is described in the 13th chapter. Verse 19. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency. It was a majestic and great city. It was growing and expanding even now in Isaiah's time. And so it needed a watchman who would say, with all of his vigilance and his determination as the watchman, that this truly was going to happen. Let him declare what he seeth. What did he see? Verse 7. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses and a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed. Now that last little bit's a little bit different. Really should read this way. Let him attend attentively, very attentively. Just write that up. Let him attend attentively. That's a real exaggeration, isn't it? Let him, the watchman, attend attentively. Very attentively. Great concentration is enjoined upon the watchman. He's got to keep looking all the time. And Isaiah, as we're pointing out, don't you go to sleep. Keep watching. Keep awake. Make sure you're watching out all the time. Let him attend attentively, very attentively. Don't miss this. See? Let him say what he said. You can see the sense of that. What's got to be proclaimed has got to be proclaimed. Go and get that watchman. Tell him to tell the people. They'll listen to a watchman. Isn't that interesting? This was really going to be said to the people. Don't think it won't happen because it's so great. Don't think because Babylon's so great it can't fall. Don't think that Rome of our day, my dear brothers and sisters, because of all of its amazing history and calling itself the eternal city, don't think it can't fall. Listen to what the watchman says. It's going to fall. He saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses and a chariot of camels. Now, it's not asses plural, it's not camels plural, it's ass and camel. It's singular. He saw a pair of horsemen. I don't think there were horsemen and then others that were looking after the camel and the ass. The horsemen were used because they were driving the camel, driving the ass. And as the watchman looked out, he saw an ass coming along and a camel coming along and a pair of men driving, right, in the chariot. Chariot with a camel and a chariot with an ass. That's a strange thing, isn't it? Whatever does that mean? Any guesses? What do you think that might mean? Well, the camel we know was the animal of the desert, wasn't he? Could it not mean, therefore, that the message is coming across from the desert? The watchman is in Jerusalem and listening, you see, very attentively to everything. He sees there's a camel and a horse and a rider on each. In the chariot of each. But they're a long way off, and he wonders what message they will bring, because that's what they look for, wasn't it? Somebody bringing a message. Remember how there's instances like that in the scriptures. In the battle of Absalom and David, or David's forces, David waited, didn't he? Until the messenger would come, and the watchman said, I think his running is like the running of, I just forget his name. Remember that? See, they looked out to see what was coming. That's what he saw. So the camel would be an animal that was used to go across the desert. This message was coming from a long way away, across the desert, all those 500 miles that were between Jerusalem and the area of Babylon. And the ass, well, perhaps it was indicating in its lowliness that that's all that was left to escape and bring the message. It wasn't a great animal. It was just a lowly beast, and its rider in haste, as hurried as it could anyway, and brought this message. But the message was truly momentous. Now, in verse 8, there's an interesting little point there. You know the Dead Sea Scrolls? The Dead Sea Scrolls is a very beautiful copy of the original Hebrew of Isaiah. The best preserved of all the Dead Sea Scrolls is the scroll on Isaiah. Now, it was a tremendously interesting thing when they were found to unravel this scroll and see how, when it was translated, it therefore agreed or disagreed with the Isaiah that we have. Now, how do you think it went? Well, it went word by word for the whole 66 books except verse 8 of Isaiah 21. Every other word is identical. And if you're worried about the text of the Bible, take that to hand. When people say, oh, you've got the Bible from donkey's years back, ass's years back, don't you worry about it. You say this: the only book in the Dead Sea Scrolls that had a complete book was Isaiah. And there was but one word different in 66 chapters. one word different in 66 chapters. That's how accurate the scribes were. There was nothing wrong with their copying. But there was a difference, and this is what it said. I'll write it just up. It doesn't mention the word line. It's just one letter change, actually. And he that saw, that's the watchman, he that saw cried out. O Lord, I stand continually. That is to say, forget the word line, it really just complicates it. No one's been able to work out how the line got in there. You haven't got a line on top of a watchman, or you wouldn't have a watchman, would you? So it's obviously not the sense of it at all. But it's interesting that that verse in the original is slightly different. He saw, and he that saw, I've missed out a word there, and he that saw cried out, O Lord, I stand continually. And we go on in verse 8, and he emphasizes that. I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I am set in my ward whole nights. Now, what is that saying, my dear brothers and sisters? That's a pretty good watchman, isn't it? Have you ever tried to watch out a whole night? What is the prophet saying there? Or what is the watchman replying to the prophet saying? You say to me, diligently, diligently watch. Be attentive, attentively, very attentive. Look, he said, I never go to sleep. Whether it's by day or by night, I'm continually watching. In other words, that's not a man, is it? A man can't do that. He has 4 hours in the night and he changes. That was the watch. Who is it that doesn't slumber or sleep? It's he that keeps Israel, isn't it? Psalm 121. Speaks very beautifully of that. Psalm 121. Behold, verse 4 and 5. He that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. Yahweh is thy keeper. Yahweh is thy shade upon thy right hand. That statement, that this watching is going on by day and by night incessantly, in continuous vigilance, is the Spirit of God speaking as the voice of the watchman. It cannot be the statement of a man. It is, if you like, very similar to chapter 62. Very similar in sense to chapter 62. God had spoken this word concerning Babylon, and it would go on until it reached its mark, until the message was given. Until he declared what he saw. Isaiah 62 and verse 6. I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day nor night. Ye that make mention of Yahweh, keep not silence. You see, that's exactly the same sense, isn't it? They will never hold their peace day nor night. And the statement that had been made about Babylon was never going to be taken back. They will keep on saying it, saying it, saying it, until they see what they've said. And the evidence will come. Who are these watchmen then? They're really, as far as men are concerned, they're the prophets, aren't they? That would keep that message going until it be fulfilled. And it would never be retracted by God. And in the incessant watchfulness of God, so that message through the prophets would be sustained until it came about. What a very interesting thing that is. And in verse 9 we have the message. Behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. Now I think that's really just another way of describing verse 7. They have come. They were in the distance in verse 7. Now they have come. And the watchman cries out to them, what is the message? And he answered and said, did the man who drove the horse or the camel or the ass? He answered and said, Babylon is fallen. And all the graven images of her gods hath he broken into the ground. There's the message. and he was going to declare what he had seen, and he would watch and he would watch and he would watch until that should be accomplished. Just as surely as God says, I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, that shall never hold their peace until Jerusalem be made a praise and glory in the earth. So there was other watchmen that would never hold their peace until Babylon is fallen and is fallen. Tale of two cities? Very interesting, isn't it? Two completely different destinations. What is the greatest sin of Babylon? He answered, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods hath he broken unto the ground. And you know, that is the big thing about Babylon. It's the only point here that is mentioned as to why Babylon falls. If you turn to the 47th chapter, and this might be a subject later, by just one reference of many references. Chapter 47. Do you know that Isaiah has more to say about idolatry than any other prophet or any other book? There is a whole section in the 40s. I'll give you the references later, perhaps in the question period or thereabouts, where it just mentions it right through the whole of that section. And the reason was, is because it has so much to do with Babylon, and Babylon was the centre of idolatry. 47 verse 9. Speaking of the eclipse of that great city, it says, but these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. Why would they come? What was its greatest sin? They shall come upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of thy sorceries, and for the great abundance of thine enchantment. Idolatry was the keynote of that place. Verse 13. Thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. Idolatry was the keynote of that city. Verse 12 says the same thing. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries. And so they fall together. And that's the one thing that is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 21 and verse 9. If you want to put a little lovely footnote by that, who was the man who went into Babylon first? A little boy called Daniel. And with what age do you think he was? 17? Within what? A year or two? This little boy from Jerusalem was made head over all the astrologers and magicians and soothsayers of Babylon. End of chapter 2. Now, isn't that incredibly interesting? One of our little Sunday school students, as it were, that had his head in the pages of God's word, knows more than all the wisdom of the world. Realise that, my dear young people. And when they try to stuff your heads with all the philosophy of this world, you remember Daniel. They try to do the same thing. And in a most remarkable thing, this kingdom of idolatry, that was the source of all wickedness and sorceries, within 12 or 18 months, that young boy was put over all of that wisdom. What an incredibly interesting thing that was. That was not just by chance. It was God showing Israel that a young boy of Israel knows more than all of them put together. And so it's true for us today. Our young men and our young girls don't have to listen to the wisdom of this world. You know more because of what your parents have told you, because of the word of God, than the world outside can ever teach us. And we've got to be strong to understand that and to stand against the inroads. Well, that was the great iniquity of this place. It's the one thing mentioned. She's fallen for her idolatry. And verse 10, O my threshing and the corn of my floor. See, the margin says, the son of my floor. And the sense of that is that Babylon was born for threshing. It was born for God's judgment. It came into existence to illustrate the judgment of God. The corn of my floor, the son of my floor, the threshing floor is what's referred to. And threshing is the symbol of judgment. Another reference, Jeremiah 51, quickly, verse 33. Jeremiah 51, verse 33. For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor. It is time to thresh her, yet a little while, and the time of her harvest shall come. That which I have heard, says Isaiah, that which I have heard of Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto you. And just finally, turn to Revelation chapter 18. Babylon is fallen, Babylon's working again today, gathering a great number of nations together, historically Catholic nations of Europe. And the stage is being set. The European common market is gradually growing, with some setbacks, and then comes back strong again. And when the heart of that system, which is Rome itself, is fallen, we read in verse 1 of Revelation 18, "After these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory." He's in the team of watchmen, isn't he? The divine watchmen that have never given up until this should be fulfilled. They've never forgotten what God has said. They will declare and declare and declare until it comes. And he cried mightily, with a strong voice, saying, "Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. Become the habitation of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, the cage of every unclean and hateful bird." And did Belshazzar have a table? "All nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, more than 1,000 princes. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her." And can you imagine what was happening in the back rooms of that palace? "And the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Prepare the table. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and she receive not of her plagues." In the very vortex of that event, there was coming liberty for the children of God that would leave Babylon and go back to Jerusalem. And so it is for us, isn't it? There's another table prepared for us, my dear brothers and sisters, not upon which there will be seen the lascivious riot of Babylon, or the corruption of doctrine that has been the hallmark of her behaviour through the years. There will come truth and righteousness, and a beautiful king that will grace the world with righteousness and peace. And pray God we will be there at that time as faithful watchmen. Thank you.
We certainly have got through a very varied chapter of Isaiah, chapter 21, dealing with the burden of the sea, and we have seen how Babylon there is most definitely referred to. And we thank Brother Brian for his words to us this night.